This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Growing up, Katie Mack was a lot like other kids, used to take things apart just to see how they worked, had a fascination with the stars and the moon. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to grow up to be an astrophysicist. But in fact, she did. And now she's a professor in the Department of Physics at North Carolina State University, and her area of focus is nothing less than the beginning and end of the universe. Many people here on Earth best know Katie for her Twitter presence. She tweets under the handle AstroKatie, and Katie Mack is with us now. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks. It's really good to be here.
How'd you become interested in the universe?
I was always interested in how things work, I always wanted to understand everything around me in every possible way. And at some point, I started to sort of look farther and farther out, and I started to discover things that are so weird, they just mess with your brain, you know, black holes and space-time warping and the Big Bang. And that was the ultimate figure it out. That was the ultimate everything to figure it out. And so I just got hooked on that. You know, I just wanted to understand all of it. I wanted to understand the weirdest things and the most fascinating, the most bizarre things. Things that sound like somebody's just made something up and, you know, they're just messing with you. But actually, there's evidence that that's a real physical thing out in the universe. You know, that was what I wanted to do.
So when did that knowledge and consciousness come to? I mean, when did you start hearing about black holes? Was that later in life? Or
no. When I was very young, yeah. I don't know exactly when. By the time I was about 10 years old, I knew this stuff was out there. I read Discover magazine, and that was all sorts of stuff about astronomy and physics. And I read science fiction when I could, and I read some children's, like young adult novels about that had weird physics in them as science fiction stories. And my mom was really into science fiction when I was a kid, and still is. And she also was just generally interested in science, and so she would do things like have the Feynman lectures playing as a book on tape in the car just for her own interest.
Richard Feynman,
the
developer of quantum electrodynamics.
Yes,
this is nothing less than what happens at the subatomic level, which had puzzled even the nuclear scientists forever.
Yeah. And there are these series of lectures that he's produced that are sort of aimed at general public level or a little bit above, but, you know, people who are interested in that. And so she would listen to that, and I started hearing about that, and then I started to learn about things like black holes and time travel and things like that from stuff that was in the popular press. So Stephen Hawking, the book A Brief History of Time, I had a copy of that when I was a kid, and I would read through that and try and understand everything in that. And of course, at the time, I didn't understand everything, but I thought it was really amazing and really cool. And I think what happened was at some point I found out that what Stephen Hawking does is called cosmology. He's a cosmologist. And I said, okay, that's what I want to do. I want to be a cosmologist because I want to do what he's doing. And so I just kept at that.
Yeah. Did you, I mean, and again, the stuff with Feynman, I mean, I listened to those lectures too a long, long time ago. And you start, it upends your world because he so matter-of-factly suggests that at the subatomic level, there's a lot of weird stuff going on, particularly with regard to time and the way particles react as though it did happen, something had happened before the event actually occurred. So a kind of time travel. But he's clear to say that's not what's going on. Is that, does it upend you, or do you just want to figure out what it is he really means?
You mean at the time? Or
at the time, yeah, when you first heard that.
I think when I was that age, when I was like 10, I wasn't digging that deeply into all of the sort of subatomic physics, but I knew that there were particles, there were things that were smaller than we could detect. I knew that they were doing interesting things, and there was all this quantum uncertainty, and I thought that was really interesting, this idea that a particle can tunnel through a solid wall just by sort of probabilistically appearing on the other side. I thought that was really neat.
Right.
But I was also, I was more interested in cosmology in terms of like the nature of space, the nature of time, the Big Bang. And so there was Paul Davies wrote a book called About Time, and he gave a lecture, and I went to that public lecture and heard about how physicists think about time on sort of large scales. And then I saw a lecture by Stephen Hawking when I was probably like 14. And that was all about his work about the Big Bang and the future and history of the universe. And
you had a chance meeting with Stephen Hawking.
I did at that time, yeah. We were coming out of the lecture hall, and we happened to be going in the same direction as Hawking, just by chance. And I was with my mom and my best friend at the time. And I was too shy to say anything. I was like, oh my God, this is my hero. And so my friend Gaurav went up to him and said, oh, my friend would like to speak to you.
I think she likes you.
right. And so I sort of shyly walked up and I said, you know, I really admire your work. And he said, thank you very much. That was an amazing moment for me. And then I just kind of carried on. And that lecture happened at Caltech. And so I'd heard about Caltech as a place to go to study science because my grandfather had spent time there while he was in the Navy during World War II learning meteorology.
But he played, if I may interrupt you there,
had
a role. He worked with NASA in conjunction with NASA or for NASA at least on one of the launches.
Yeah, he was very involved in Apollo 11 in a really big way. He actually, in some sense, saved the lives of the Apollo 11 astronauts. It's a wonderful, dramatic story. He was in the Navy, and he was working on whether satellites or balloons and satellites and things like that, rockets, trying to learn more about the weather using these new technologies. Mm-hmm. And at some point, he was assigned to do the weather for the Apollo 11 mission, specifically the splashdown phase. So, you know, the capsule goes, it comes back, and as it comes back, it has to come back through the atmosphere and land in the ocean. And it's really important that as it comes down through the atmosphere, it doesn't encounter a big storm or something because it has to come down gently. And so he was in charge of making sure that the landing site was okay. So he had all these maps, you know, all this usual stuff, and it looked fine. But he also had access to secret spy satellites from the Cold War that he knew had better data. And he had that clearance because he was in the Navy and he was part of these sort of weather missions, but he had that secret clearance. And NASA did not. And so he went out to another base and he contacted a colleague of his and said he wanted to look at these maps. And as soon as he contacted the colleague said, you have to see this right now. It turned out there was a huge storm. They called it a screaming eagle thunderstorm. Wow. And there were these clouds, this storm that were right where the landing site was supposed to be. And only these spy satellites had a good enough view to see it. And it was such a strong storm, if they tried to land there, it would rip the parachutes right off the capsule. Would have killed everyone on impact with the ocean. And so my grandfather had to go back to NASA and say, you have to move the landing site. I cannot tell you why.
Secret satellite? Oh,
it was a secret.
Oh,
wow. He couldn't reveal the existence of these satellites. He couldn't tell NASA anything about them because NASA was a civilian organization and he was
about to spend them a lot of money, which they don't like. So
right.
Tell me how this turns out.
And it was going to be a big risk, you know, because it was only 72 hours before the splashdown. And so they were going to have to reroute things. And, you know, whenever you change something in a space mission, that's a risk. And so the commander, whoever he had to report to, said, okay, we're going to do this because I trust you, but we're also going to send a plane to the original site, and if there's nothing there, you're done.
Luckily, there was a storm. How did the plane get out of it?
But the plane was okay because you just had to see that it was there, and it wasn't bad enough to kill a plane, but parachutes would have been a problem. So, the storm was there. The astronauts landed a few hundred kilometers away. They were fine. Everything was great. They came home heroes, and my grandfather continued his career.
That's good to hear. So, Katie, tell us more about this. We've gotten a lot of your early interest in science, but it's not just science. You were also an athlete. You liked to play sports.
Yeah, I was always real active, real sporty. I did track and field when I was a kid, you know, running, jumping, all of that stuff. I played flag football. When I was 13 years old, I was the only girl in the park league playing flag football. Well, it was one of these things, you know, they have different sports for the boys and the girls. Usually it's something like they have boys basketball and girls basketball, and that was fine. But then in this particular season, they had boys flag football and they had girls volley tennis, which is a kind of weird hybrid sport between volleyball and tennis. And I tried playing it once and it was really not that much fun. And I'd already, you know, I threw the football around with the kids in my neighborhood, and so I wanted to play football. And there was no girls' football league, so I told my mom, and my mom has always been a very sort of forward-thinking activist type person, and she's like, all right, we're going to do this. And so marched us to the park office, and we said we're signing up for flag football, and they were like, okay. And so I signed up and I joined the team, and there were no other girls.
Were you any good?
I think I was pretty good. The boys wouldn't throw the ball to me. At age 13, there are social norms that happen. When they did, I made a touchdown. But most of the time, I played on the line, which is strange because I was kind of a spindly person. I wasn't sort of big linebacker type, but I didn't disgrace myself. It was a lot of fun. I think I got the sportsmanship award that year.
Oh, no. If you had to play another year, you would have gotten most improved.
Yeah.
But later, you'd have been receiver of the year. Listen, so we've talked about science, and now a little bit about sports. And when we come back, we're going to talk about religion, the trifecta. And we're going to find out more about Katie Mack and her career in astrophysics on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Katie Mack today, an astrophysicist, cosmologist, and professor at NC State. Her focus is how the universe began and how it's going to end, which I hope takes us at least to the end of this program. Tell us, we're talking a little bit about the fact that you like sports. You played a lot of sports. You also had an interest in religion.
Yeah, I think that part of trying to understand everything was trying to understand why people believe in things and how all of that works. And I grew up in a church, in a Protestant church, United Church of Christ denomination. And I was pretty active in sort of the youth group and everything. And I just kind of wanted to have a better feeling for how all that stuff works, you know. So when I was in middle school and high school, I would go with my friends to their religious services and try and see what that was like. And I would read all sorts of things about that. And at some point during high school, I went with a friend to the synagogue down the road from my church, and I found it fascinating. And it was interesting because it was kind of a different take on the same stories, and they had different music, and they had a different way of conducting the service. And it was very reflective, and I liked the idea of having a period of time every week where you sort of think about how you interact with the world, how you feel about your own actions and other people's actions. I really wanted to learn how to be a better person in the world and how to treat people better and what really is a good way to live, you know?
Well, it is interesting because Judaism famously, from what I've been told about it, and the primary difference in the way Christianity approaches religion and Judaism is that Judaism takes the word as something that is living, that you interact with. So I'm really bouncing off of what you just said. The idea is that this word doesn't explain how things work. It was never meant to explain how things got here and how things work. It's meant to help us do what you said, if you can interact with this on a daily basis within your community.
Yeah, there's a lot of back and forth about, okay, here's what the text says. What does that mean for us? How should we best interact with it? And to be fair, the church that I grew up in also had a lot of that. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of, it was not a fundamentalist church.
Right.
So the text was not the beginning and the end.
Right.
It was a sort of ongoing conversation. So there were similarities in the different approaches. But there was also at the synagogue a kind of emphasis on you are very much personally responsible for how you live and how you treat people, and you were very held accountable in lots of ways. For example, in Judaism during the high holidays, there's a period of time when you're expected to make right with everybody you know, because the idea is that you have this Day of Atonement and it atones for sins against God, but not for sins against other people. You have to actually ask forgiveness. And that was something I hadn't encountered in quite that literal and regimented a way in other faith traditions. And I thought that was really fascinating. And so there was a time when I was going to church on Sunday mornings and synagogue on Friday nights. And and it was, I guess I there are a lot of things if I do it, I sort of overdo it. That was probably an example of that. But it was also a bit of a strange situation because I didn't have faith per se. I had a lot of trouble believing in anything that I didn't have sort of strong evidence for. Mm-hmm. It comes back to the scientific viewpoint, maybe. I didn't have religious experiences. I didn't have a feeling of connection with the divine. I wanted that feeling of connection. I think that most people do. I think most human beings want a connection with a higher power, a greater being, a greater force. And I couldn't find that in religion. But I had that desire, and I found the practice very very meaningful and very centering and very interesting. And so I would continue the practice, but I never got the faith.
You never decided to be a rabbi. However, you did have a lifelong dream of going to Caltech.
I knew a lot about Caltech because of my grandfather, because he spent time there. He would tell stories about his interactions with the scientists there, because he was one of the military people brought in to learn a specific thing. But there were a lot of students who were just the regular Caltech students. And so there was sort of a culture clash, and he would tell me about, you know, the Navy guys would say, oh, we're going to swindle these guys at poker. And, you know, the Caltech students would count cards and they'd just mop the floor with them, you know, and there would be all of these kinds of interactions, and there were all these pranks, you know, people would take a professor's car and disassemble it and reassemble it in a classroom and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there were amazing stories, and it just seemed like a place where you could really explore science and be embedded in that community and that mission of understanding the world better. And so I went to Caltech as an undergrad and studied physics there, which was a very intense experience.
It was, because there was a point at which you had a scholarship, but it was in jeopardy. You started not doing so well.
It was a tough place. I mean, it's, you know, it was just very intense. The work was hard. The other students were all very, very talented. One of the things that happens at a place like Caltech, you have to be within the top 10% of your class, usually much higher, to get into Caltech. Then once you're there, everybody's used to being at the top, and there's a spread. And so I went in with a merit scholarship. One of the terms of that scholarship was that I had to maintain a B average. And there were times when it was really close, when it wasn't entirely clear that was going to happen. And it was strange because I was used to getting straight A's the rest of my schooling. But at Caltech, you know, it was a tough place.
New league. Add to this, you begin to struggle with your gender identity and your sexuality.
Not my gender identity, but yeah.
Your sexuality.
Yeah, at some point during Caltech, I started to realize that I might not be entirely straight. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because I should have been totally fine with that. I grew up in a church that was open to all different identities and very publicly, very loudly open to everything. My family, my mom was very supportive of that. The synagogue I went to also was very open, you know. My environment was pretty accepting, but it was different when it was me. You know, it was hard to figure out who I was and how that fit into how I saw myself.
Well, how did the questions first arise for you?
Well, I started to suspect things, I guess, when I was in high school. I would admire girls, but I didn't know how exactly. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who turn out to be queer say that when they were kids, they thought that they just really admired their best friend, or, you know, something like that. Mm. And so I had those kinds of things. And then at some point I went through a breakup during college, and I realized that I was going to have to come to terms with this because I didn't know who I should be looking for in my next relationship.
You were dating a man at the time.
I'd been dating a man, and then we broke up, and I didn't know if maybe I was gay and I should only look to date women in the future, or maybe I was really straight and it was just some kind of strange, you know, phase that teenagers go through. Mm. And so I feel like coming out as bisexual is hard because you don't have that sort of certainty where it's like, well, I'm obviously not attracted to anyone of that gender, so I must be on this other side. Or, you know, I guess if you're asexual, then it's difficult in both directions also. But with when you're bi, you know, you might have a crush on someone, but then you're not sure if it's a real crush or if it's just some kind of fluke. And so I had this period of time where I kept thinking, what if I wake up tomorrow and I'm straight, or I wake up tomorrow and I'm gay? And if I get into a relationship, I don't know if that's if I'm dooming it because I chose wrong.
You know? We had a conversation with your mother. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So my mom was always very, very accepting. And one of her sisters was bisexual. And she told me that when I was a little kid. Oh. I remember being told that, you know, our aunt was bisexual. And I asked, what does that mean? And my mom said, oh, it means a bisexual person can love a man or a woman. And I thought, okay, that's fine. That makes sense. So I knew she would be accepting, but I was still very nervous telling her about it. I very much remember the phone call, even just like being on the phone and trying to explain this thing. Mm-hmm. And I later found out that she wasn't surprised per se, except that she thought that the reason that I had that big breakup with the boy was that probably I wasn't into boys at all. So she had thought that I was probably actually just a lesbian. And she was surprised that I did like boys. So I found out at some point that one of my ministers in my church also thought that. So everybody was confused. I was confused. Nobody knew what was going on.
Why do you think? I mean, you explained a little bit about the sort of the difficulty of coming to terms with being bi, because it sort of leaves you with these doubts in both directions. But why the reluctance to talk about it at all? Because that does seem to be something that you didn't want to acknowledge, even though all these people around you, you know, made it mostly clear that that would be okay with them.
Yeah, I think I just was not comfortable talking about sexuality in any way. I was in those kinds of terms. I was still pretty young at the time. Yeah. I had not had very many relationships. They had not been very serious. And the idea of I didn't want to be perceived as a sexual person in any way. And it's one of the funny things about if you come out as bisexual, if you come out as gay or lesbian, you say, I'm gay, I'm lesbian, fine. If you come out as bisexual, the word sex is in that word. it's kind of hard to avoid. Yeah. And so when you say I'm bisexual, it sounds like an overshare. It sounds like this kind of, you know, you're throwing sex into this picture. And I didn't want to be doing that in any way. And a lot of my friends at that time were very conservative religious people as well. And I didn't know what would happen with those friendships. My dad was a very conservative person, and I didn't know how he would react to it. He didn't react well as it happened, but it wasn't, I was already out of the house. It didn't matter that much. But I didn't want people to see me differently, and I didn't want people to see me as, there's a stereotype of bisexuals as being, you know, promiscuous, oversexed people, and I didn't see myself that way at all, and I didn't want other people to see myself that way. I didn't want people to think about sex at all in any context around me, and so it's hard to talk about that if that's your situation.
And was part of this turmoil that you were going through, do you think that was part of what was going on in school as well?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot going on at that time that it was just a really complicated time with my personal life, with my friends, and my sort of figuring out who I was. There were sort of financial things happening, and but I got through it. I passed my classes eventually.
And then ended up studying theology.
Yeah. So I mentioned Caltech being a very intense place. I knew I was going to go to grad school. I knew I wanted to get a PhD in astrophysics, but I also knew that if I went straight from Caltech physics to astrophysics at another university, I would probably completely burn out. And I didn't want to do that. And I had this interest in theology over the years, and I wanted to explore that a little bit. And so I decided I would apply to grad school, but I would defer to admission for a year. And I would also apply to theology schools. And I would spend a year just studying religion and why people believe things and scripture and everything. And so I ended up enrolling at Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, California, in a certificate of theological studies course, a one-year course, and I deferred admission to Princeton for astrophysics PhD.
What did you learn from that experience?
I learned a lot about religion. Yeah. I studied theology, sociology of religion, biblical Hebrew, the Old Testament. I met a lot of people who were really wonderful people. Most of the students were people who were intending to go into theology, into the, you know, clergy.
And you were more or less going into this as an anthropologist, right? I mean, you were trying to understand it. Did that create a cultural sort of difference between you and other students?
I mean, I think a lot of the students were also there as sort of students, you know, in an academic kind of context, mm-hmm. but everybody had some kind of faith. You know, it didn't always take the same form, but there was a kind of just general understanding that, you know, that all of this stuff has a real spiritual mm-hmm. existence. And at some point while I was there, that rift did start to feel noticeable. And so I thought, well, maybe this isn't the right thing to focus on. And I ended up leaving the program early, and I went off to Cambridge University to do a short-term research project there, and then I started grad school.
Encounter with Stephen Hawking at Cambridge? Was that where?
That was a little later on. I went to Cambridge several times. Okay. It was sort of a hangout in a sense. But while I was, in grad school, I did spend a year in Cambridge, and I did encounter Hawking again in a very dramatic way.
Tell us about that.
So this was during my third year of Princeton, during my PhD program. And I was spending a year doing some research with people at Cambridge and sitting in on a course called Part 3 Mathematics, which is a sort of theoretical physics course, very intense study in things like quantum field theory and GR, or general relativity, mm-hmm. and mathematical physics. And while I was there, it turns out when you visit another astronomy or physics department, usually the seminar organizer will find you and say, okay, when are you giving us a talk? Because they need people to give talks. And when you visit, that's just what you do. Mm-hmm. And I was just a grad student, but I was there as a researcher. And so they were like, yeah, come give a talk during the cosmology lunch. And so I'm like, okay, I guess I can do this. I'm scared, but I will do this. The reason I was scared is that this is the lunch that Stephen Hawking goes to. This is the cosmology lunches. And I knew that there was a possibility he would be there, along with all of the professors teaching the courses that I was sitting in on. And I would be there speaking to them, which was terrifying.
At Cambridge,
yeah. And so I showed up to the lecture, and I had my slides all prepared. And all of my lecturers were sitting in the audience looking up at me, but Hawking wasn't there. So I thought, okay, maybe it'll be all right. And just as I'm getting ready to show my title slide, I hear this beeping as his chair is rolling in. So he shows up with his carer, you know, doing the feeding stuff. And I put up my title slide, and it's about primordial black holes, which is a topic that he invented, basically. He came up with, him and some other scientists came up with the theory that you could have black holes that form in the very first moments of the universe, and maybe they can grow and become something interesting. And this is what I was talking about. And so as soon as I put up the title slide, I hear this mechanical voice say, "Thank you." And I thought, well, that's interesting. So, and everybody kind of laughed, and I assumed that he was saying, like, "No, you're talking about my theory, thanks." Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, just kind of carried on. And as I went, every once in a while, I would hear "no," or "yes," or "I don't know," or "I don't think so," just at seemingly random times in the talk. And I would look at Hawking, and he's just there, you know, looking mm-hmm. up at me. And I'd look at the carer, and she had the sort of blank look on her face, just sort of shrugging. And I didn't know what to do, because you can't ask him to explain, because it takes... At that time, it would take him a minute or two to form one word. Mm-hmm. So you can't have a conversation back and forth. So I didn't know if he was commenting on my slides or if it was some kind of random thing that he was thinking about something else. So I just had to carry on. And it was a grueling talk as well, because some of the professors were quite, you know, they would ask lots and lots of questions. And so I had to really be on top of things. And then my hero was sitting there in the audience, you know, apparently... apparently sort of heckling me. And, so eventually, you know, the talk is finished. It goes fine. People clap. Hawking goes away. And I asked the seminar organizer, what was going on with Hawking? What was that? And he says, oh, well, you know, his word selection program works by looking at a spot on his cheek. And when he sort of winks, it selects words. And it malfunctions when he's eating.
So, oh my God!
It was a lunchtime seminar.
Oh wow!
So he got
bangers in his circuitry, and
so it just like there's a sort of selection of quick select words. You know, yes, no, maybe, I don't know, I don't think so. Thank you, and it would just randomly select from that little menu. And you can't turn it off because then he has no way of speaking. So it has to be on all the time. It has to be full volume.
You end up feeling better about that, huh?
Yeah. I had a story afterward, for sure.
The story belongs to astrophysicist Katie Mack of NC State, currently writing a book on how the universe might end. We'll get a preview when we return on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Katie Mack, who since childhood has been fascinated with the unknowns of the universe and turned that passion into a career in astrophysics. Currently a professor at NC State, her focus is how the universe began and how it may end, looking at things like dark matter and black holes. The beginning of this to me is the holy grail for science and physics, because in my furry little pea brain, I get that physics really begins with the beginning of the universe, because that's all right. Stuff happens, and now we're measuring all the stuff happening, the dynamics. So we really have – is there any way to infer from what we know in physics what happened before there was physics?
What we can do is try to take what we can observe and what we can indirectly understand about the very earliest moments down to – you know, a fraction of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second. And we can extrapolate from that what kind of physical model that fits into. And then that might match with a model that has a singularity at the beginning where everything was infinitely dense and time was wrapped up in that. Or it might, you can come up with models where you have a sort of cyclic universe that goes from Big Crunch to Big Bang, or you can have different universes colliding with one another to create new universes. There are lots of different ways that things could go. And there are people who really do study sort of before that first moment, if there is a before that first moment, or how that came about. But it is indirect. It has to be indirect, because if you think there was a singularity where you have this infinitely dense state, you can't see through that. And so you have to indirectly infer what kind of larger global model of physics that fits into, and then use that to try to figure out what could have been on the other side if there was another side.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other question a layperson might ask is where'd the stuff, even if there was a singularity, a lot of stuff packed together tightly, where'd that come from?
That's another question that at the moment we don't have an answer to. There are different models where you have sort of everything comes from nothing in some sort of sense. You can have situations where there's no boundary in space or time at that moment. This is something that Hawking used to talk about. But at the moment, we don't have a solid answer to that question.
What is it particularly that you're looking at, and sort of what is the moment that you're focusing on, and what are you interested in?
I've studied a few different things in that area. I've studied the process of cosmic inflation, which is a period of time in the very, very early universe where the universe may have been expanding very rapidly, very quickly, and increasing in size to a massive degree in an extremely short time. And that process could be responsible for sort of the distribution of matter in the universe that we see today. And so I've done some research studying that process from a theoretical standpoint. I also study dark matter, which is a kind of invisible stuff that seems to be most of the matter in the universe. And that's not directly related to the very beginning, but there's a lot of particle theory that goes into that may be connected to some of those very first moments. And it's a big portion of what the universe seems to be made of. And so I sort of try to understand how everything fits together in that. And then I also go a little more recent and look at the first galaxies, which is recent in the sense of being 12 billion years ago, but instead of, you know, 13 and a bit. But I study how dark matter fits into that. And then more recently, I've also been thinking a little bit about the end of the universe and what that might look like. And there are a lot of similarities to the kind of physics you use to study the very beginning and the very end. And so I'm thinking a lot about where things might be going and how we can find that out.
Does it have to end? The last time I looked, and yeah, I may have missed a chapter, there's a debate about whether there's enough, I think, dark matter to bring us all back. Will
sure
there be enough? Are we slowing down at a rate that the thing will all contract,
mm-hmm,
or not, in which case we'll just keep going forever?
Yeah, yeah. So that was the biggest question in cosmology in sort of the 90s, was this question of, Is there enough matter in the universe that the current expansion will at some point reverse due to gravity, or will we keep going forever? At the moment, it looks like it's not going to turn around, so we will not have a big crunch. However, there are other ways for the universe to end. It doesn't have to end by all collapsing again. Even if the universe is expanding forever and constantly accelerating in its expansion, which is what looks like might happen, the universe comes to an end in the sense that everything in the universe decays and dies. And so that's called the heat death. So this is something that is sort of the most likely thing, that the universe keeps expanding so fast that at some point, you know, new stars can't form, the old stars burn out, particles decay, and you end up with a cold, dark, empty universe. And in a sense, that's very much an end of the universe. And that, and even in a technical sense, there's a way in which once you get to that state, the arrow of time doesn't really have a meaning anymore, and so you can't have a future anymore after that.
But that raises the very interesting question, which I would think is the thing that would keep a highly qualified astrophysicist up at night, this riddle of life, that stuff mm-hmm. which replicates itself and then slows down the decay by constantly reproducing in ways that gas doesn't seem to want to do. Gas will peter out and, you know, be something other than what it is.
Well, it doesn't technically slow down the decay, because anytime you do something, you reproduce, you build a thing, you're putting more disorder into the universe somewhere else. Like, let's say that you put together a puzzle. You know, you take disorder and you make order out of it. In the process of putting together that puzzle, you've expended effort. You've mm-hmm. used your muscles. You've burned the calories. You've sweated. You've breathed and done cellular respiration. In the end, the environment you're in is more disordered, even if that puzzle looks nice and pretty. And so this is something that comes up a lot in physics, that entropy, the disorder of the universe, is always increasing no matter what you try to do. There's no way to slow that down or stop that. You're always creating more entropy. And as the universe continues, this is the second law of thermodynamics, as the universe goes on, the disorder keeps growing, the entropy gets higher, and eventually you'll reach this maximum entropy state, which is the end of the universe.
So even if you have some weird freak of nature over here that's figured out a way to reproduce itself and give the illusion of permanence, you too will die, but at least for a moment you think you were here for a long time. You're just sowing more disorder somewhere else.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Is life a freak when it comes to most of what's going on in the universe? The idea that something has the ability to replicate itself in some form or another?
I mean, it's hard to say. As a cosmologist, life is a little bit outside my sort of usual thinking. Mm-hmm. It seems to be something that, based on the physics we understand, can arise from chemistry. There are chemical processes that you tweak a little bit and they become more like biological processes. And life seems to be able to arise from, you know, the right kinds of collisions or the right kinds of chemicals that are in the right kinds of environment. And probably it's everywhere. I mean, probably we're not the only place where life happens. Mm-hmm. Probably life is out there. But how it fits into a cosmological sense, my impression is that life doesn't really matter that much in terms of the broader universe. I mean, even just the kind of particles we're made of, regular matter, is only like 5% of what the universe is made of. There's dark energy, which is whatever's making the universe expand faster. That's about 70% of the universe. There's dark matter, which is this invisible extra gravity stuff. Dark matter is something like 25% of the universe. Then there's this little 5% slice that's everything we can see and touch and interact with. And, you know, life is such a tiny sliver of even that. The idea that we have any impact is unlikely, I think.
Well, to say nothing of the fact that this one particular life form, which we call human, has this freakish capacity to construct meaning out of thin air, to make stuff up, to make stuff up about identities, to make stuff up about national social identities, personal identities, all of which we know from having studied the way the mind works is an artifice. I mean, essentially, a healthy mind is hallucinating, right? It's creating meaning in its own mind. So, which is interesting to speculate about, and as you suggest, we might be wise to get over ourselves as living beings. There's not much of us, and if we were that important, you should think there might be more. But also, it raises questions about the inquiry itself. This makes us as scientists not really reliable narrators. Do you worry about sort of that? I mean, not to fall into solipsism here, but it should give you cause.
No, definitely. I think that it's a big misconception that science is this ultimate, objective endeavor, and scientists have nothing that they bring into it. I feel like it kind of goes back and forth. Some people say, oh, scientists are all motivated by X or Y and therefore are unreliable. And some people say, well, science is this high and mighty thing that is the ultimate search for truth, and it has to be correct and all that. It's somewhere in the middle. You know, we all have our own biases. We all have our own sort of motivations. I think that over time, the process of science really does help us get closer to what we hope is reality. I mean, really, the kind of science I do is about building a mathematical model of the universe and trying to find a mathematical model that fits the observations better and gives us the ability to make predictions about other observations. And that's all it is, really. We're just trying to find better and better mathematical models. Whether or not it really corresponds to ultimate reality is a little hard to say.
You're doing the science in a particular context, and you're asking particular questions that make sense to people in time. The kind of science that you're doing is roughly speaking, goes back about 500 years. This doesn't go back forever, this mode of inquiry.
Yeah.
And before that, the storytelling we did about the way things work was much different. I'm wondering about this particular moment, this contemporary moment in history, where we find so much skepticism about science now, a growing hostility toward science after this kind of, burst of science is our future, when everyone seemed to embrace science as the way forward. Is there a divergence now? Is it coming apart in the sense that, in terms of public confidence?
I think this is a real complicated question. Most people, if you ask them if they like science, they'll say, yeah, I like science. And most people think science is broadly a good thing for the world. There are times, though, when the process of science, the institutions of science, have hurt a lot of people. There are times when people who were conducting scientific studies or building new technology did not properly take into account the impacts they were going to have. And so there are a lot of people who have been hurt by a lot of things in modern science. And there are a lot of things in modern science that are scary and that are dangerous in some way. And there is not a perfect history of the scientific establishment being honest and straightforward and considerate of people. And so a lot of people do have, I think, valid worries about how science works and who's in charge of it and what the motivations of people are. And so it's a kind of difficult path to walk to say, as scientists, we want to promote public understanding of science. We want to promote the funding for science, the progress of science, but we also need to be considerate of how our science impacts people and how we communicate back and forth in both directions with the people who are paying for our science and the people who are impacted by our science. So my approach to that, I feel like making science as public and transparent and personal as possible helps a lot. So I try to be a very accessible scientist. I talk a lot about what I do and how I do it and who I am. And I think a lot of scientists are starting to realize that by being more accessible, more public, it becomes clear that we're not in it for the money. We're not in it for, devious purposes. We just want to understand the world. And we're not always going to get everything right in terms of either the science or the impact on the world. But we're trying, we have the best things at heart. And I think that that helps to demystify how science works and who scientists are. And I think that's a good way to move forward in that kind of environment.
You are active on social media in that way to put yourself out there, which means you get a lot of probably uncomfortable questions. What are some of the questions that you get that you feel like, all right, well, this is a good one, I'm going to take this one on, some of these difficult questions?
Well, I get a lot of questions just about science and, astronomy and physics, and I try to answer when I can, or I try to take into account what people are asking so I know what to talk about. I also sometimes do get questions about why should we put money into this? You know, why send a mission to the moon when there are people who are starving in our own country? And I think those are things that we need to wrestle with as a society. My answer for that, there are lots of different ways to answer that question. Some people will say, well, when you do some kind of new basic science, new technologies come about, the return on investment is huge, which is very much true. You know, the return on investment in basic science is massive. One of the best things we can do if we want to, you know, advance in terms of technology and economics. But my response is usually, we do science because we want to know how the world works. As a society, a basic value we have is we want to understand things. We want to have knowledge. We want to figure out how we fit into the universe. And so as a society, we've decided this is something we want to invest in. And we're going to give money to people who are doing that work so that we as a society will have a better understanding of the world. And the same way that we fund the arts because we like to have art around us. We fund music because we like music. We put money into entertainment because that makes us happy. Science makes us happy. It makes us fulfilled. It makes us have a connection to our place in the universe. And that's something that we care about as humans. And so we should fund science because we care about it as humans, because it's something that we as people, as the species, just think is really cool.
I think it's really cool. And it's been cool to spend an hour with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Katie Mack is an astrophysicist and a cosmologist and a professor at NC State University, currently writing a book on theories of how the universe might end. And you can find out more about that and our show at stateofthings.org, a show produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachel.